nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
One thing before we get started on the lecture portion, several months ago I committed to giving a talk at the American Ceramic Society meeting next Tuesday. Okay, so those of you all that have Tuesday lab, come up, show up at lab, and I'll have Bong Joon Kim run through the next two steps of the alignment with you, okay? But I won't be there. And then I'll also give my version of that the next Tuesday, because my version will still be clearer. Bong Joon's good, I'm better, okay? That's right. He's a graduate student. He's learning his way through it. I can explain it more clearly than him, okay? I'll try to make sure he says things the right way that I want it said, but I'm sure you'd want to hear it a second time anyway. So for the Tuesday people, sorry about that, but I just committed to that several months ago. Okay, before we start the lecture portion, any major questions on things? Anything that you haven't been doing okay with? Yes, sir.
How exactly do we access the video portion of the class?
It's a wonderful question. It's a wonderful question. I don't know the answer yet.
The best way is nanohub.org.
Is it up there that
yet?
That's what I was thinking, yeah.
Yeah,
so one of the things is I had one of the lecturers use a different set of slides because I had that problem with things showing up. So things like that. So it'll be up there soon enough. Yeah, soon enough. Okay. Did everyone download the homework? Take a look at it?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I don't care. Sometime before the end of the 582 class would be great. Look, this is a 600 level class generally, right? What's the point of homework? Anyone? What's the point of homework, philosophically? To understand the material, and it's me guiding you as to how I think you might understand certain portions of the material. I will look at it, I will grade it, I may assign a check or a non-check to it, but that's about as much as I care, okay? So it's mostly, please take a look at it, because I think if you look through it and do it, you'll find that the rest of the laboratory stuff makes more sense, all right? I unfortunately, again, with this is in the 640 level class, you all will have two exams. Ugh, what a pain in the neck, all right? This is right, we're learning for the sake of learning, but I do have to give you exams, so I'll do it. But I just philosophically, I don't really care that much about it. Okay. It's just something I hate is exams. All right. So we had gone through and discussed how the instrument goes together, right? We've looked at the ways that the different optics work together. We've discussed the alignment. We've discussed a bit the calibration. And so the final kind of section of the instrument that we've yet to talk about is the detection of electrons. Needless to say, this is a super important part of this because it doesn't do you much good to have an electron microscope unless you can see and quantify, preferably, the results of the interactions of the electrons with the specimen. And so the thing I want to do today is talk about electron detectors and to define some of the characteristics associated with them, just as an overview so that you learn the correct terms, know what they generally mean. And then we'll go through and talk about the primary types of electron detectors that we use. We will limit ourselves to the viewing screen, to the film, to CCDs, and there are a couple more advanced types that we'll just skip. And later on, when we talk about convergent beam diffraction, we may add in a couple slides about that. But I just am simplifying here today just by talking about these three things, okay? The reason to go through and talk about the detector characteristics is because I think that if you have just a cursory level understanding of these things, it can help you think about how to optimize your usage of these detectors to get the information you want. Additionally, some of these terms that I'm discussing are useful for other types of detectors and thoughts, so it's just general education for you as well. And thirdly, you may at some point be required to buy a detector for your own instrument, and so it's useful to know what things to talk about and return to. Okay, so the first of these is just simply gain. Gain is the magnitude of the amplification of the signal. So if you have a media that is taking and converting electrons to, say, light so that you can use that to image, then what you want to know is how much gain do you get, how much amplification of the original signal do you have in the detector that you are using. Okay, that's not too dissimilar to the ideas in using your stereo amplifier, right? You just kick up the gain if you want something to have a louder output, okay? The other kind of competing thing that we worry about is something called shot noise. Essentially, this is just random fluctuations that happen in the electronics or other aspects of the detector media, and it provides a lower limit on the detectability of electrons. So if you are operating in a mode where you have the beam very broadly spread on top of your CCD camera, for example, and you are going to see that you do not necessarily have a direct correlation between the interaction of an electron with your detector, because there may be some electronic noise within the CCD which will show up as a count. Okay, so this shot noise provides the lower limit of what you can detect in terms of getting a conversion of an electron to some signal. In the case of a CCD, that would be an electronic signal. In the case of film, it would be the changing of the film chemistry to get the conversion. So we'll talk about those modes in particular. But basically, shot noise is just the lower limit. And what you want to do is minimize shot noise in any detector so that you can provide a better overall signal-to-noise ratio. Another thing to talk about is the resolution. Again, this is an obviously idea to think about, is what's the resolution of the media. It's related to the size of the imaging pixel, but it's not really quite as simple as that. The real thing that you want to do to define resolution is you want to discuss what's called the point spread function. In other words, if you have a pixel, the question is whether or not a given electron into the detector unit results in signal only within one pixel. It's possible, via scattering of the electron, other things that we'll talk about later, that you may have multiple pixels receiving signal from a electron that comes in at a given point. And so there may be some spread over which the information is depicted, right, that comes about from the image media itself. So in other words, if you have a point object into your detector, a single electron into a point, you will not necessarily, for a given detector, see that at just that point. There will be some breadth around that point where you may find some signal come out. And so the point spread function, which is usually measured as what's called the modulation transfer function, or the MTF, is the real resolution of importance for the detector. So if you're buying a detector, you want to investigate what's the MTF, not just the quote-unquote resolution. Now, when you are using a digital camera, right, you are thinking about resolution by just simply buying more pixels, right? You know, if you have a 6-megapixel chip, right, then you are thinking, great, that's the maximum resolution. And generally, that will correlate, as you increase the number of pixels, it will correlate to changes in real resolution as well, but they are not one-to-one. And so this is important if you are buying a particular CCD for your microscope. You do not want to necessarily just buy something based on pixels, but you want to look at the modulation transfer function. And generally, for a given increment of money that you have to spend, you will be in a particular range of what you can afford. If you have something like $50,000 to spend, you will be looking at a 1K by 1K camera. And you would like to evaluate several different manufacturers. The MTF is a way to do that, more than just simply saying, they're all 1K by 1K, thus they're the same, okay? Because it does give you a real resolution measurement, all right? Additionally, you also want to consider dynamic range, and this is, for the media, what is the ability to show differences between dark and bright? In other words, what's the ratio of the brightest pixel that you can have to the dimmest pixel? This is particularly important when talking about diffraction patterns, because in the case of diffraction patterns, we are going to be looking at images of the diffraction events where the electrons are highly localized in a single place due to the diffraction event. And so you'll get lots of really bright regions, right, and lots of very dim regions. And you would like to be able to display lots of intensity range or dynamic range by having an area that's quite bright and an area that's quite dim showing up in your particular media. And so the dynamic range is something that's, again, useful to evaluate when you're considering a detector. If you have a low dynamic range, you will find that your diffraction patterns are more difficult to display nicely on that particular detector. Okay? These things are also discussed frequently in terms of what's called the DQE, or the detection quantum efficiency. This is another parameter to consider when talking about your overall detector performance, because what you want to do is you want to figure out what's the ratio between the signal to noise that you get out of the detector versus the real signal to noise in the detector, right? And again, this DQE number is something that tells you how much you are amplifying noise within the electronics, for example, or the system in general. And so you want to have something where you get a fairly good level of reproducibility without the additional noise information coming from your detector itself. And so DQE is another term that gets frequently used. And you want to push that towards the number of one. Okay? Now, some terms to talk about with overall conversion of electrons to photons, right? Because really we have no ability, right, with our eyes to see an electron, so we have to have some way to convert it to a photon. There are general terms that are used and that are worth going over. The term cathodoluminescence is whenever you are producing visible light from the impact of a high-energy electron in a solid. So what you are doing is you are taking a high-energy electron and you are using that to create a transition in the electronic structure of that material so that you have the electron go from the valence band up to the conduction band, and then upon returning down to the empty hole, a photon coming out. And so you have to have a direct band gap material for this to work, right? And cathodoluminescence is just the broad term for the creation of visible light from the impact of high energy electrons, okay? There are more specific terms also. Another general term is scintillation, and this is an even more broad term than cathodoluminescence. It just says that you've got light emission coming from some form of ionizing radiation, not necessarily the impact of a high-energy electron. The reason to talk about scintillation is it's a very general term, and when people talk about the screen that we use to image the electron, sometimes they'll call that a scintillator screen, and so it's just so that you know the term. More generally, people call it the fluorescent screen, but in fact, it is undergoing both fluorescence and phosphorescence. Fluorescence is whenever you have a rapid emission of light coming from this same electron to photon conversion. Phosphorescence is something that takes a bit longer, and the only difference between them is that the fluorescence is usually directly going from the band gap back and forth, and phosphorescence is usually mediated by a defect state within the gap, and so there's some longer residence time to the presence of the electron in a higher energy state, and thus the conversion takes longer time to happen. And so you end up, if you look down on the screen, we'll do this again in the labs, if you move the sample, you will notice a bit of a ghost image on the screen for a couple of portions of a second, usually, as that thing fluoresces, and pardon me, as the thing phosphoresces and comes back to its new conversion of electrons to photons, okay? It's called usually the fluorescent screen, but again, we're also dealing with phosphorescence when using it. So the first thing to talk about in terms of electron detection is the viewing screen. We use the viewing screen to allow us to align the microscope, to align the sample conditions for diffraction, to get a sense of what's going on. The green screen does not take a permanent image, and so it's merely used to help us decide on what to do with our sample in terms of imaging. In some of the most modern microscopes, as CCD cameras are advancing, sometimes the fluorescent screen is just going away and being replaced solely by a high image rate CCD, and so that's increasingly common. The green screen, though, is present in most of the older microscopes. I still like it myself, so I personally like to see them on things that I buy. That's just a preference. Maybe that's because I'm old-fashioned. But generally what you're doing with this is you're using a particular direct band gap material, either zinc sulfide or a combination of zinc sulfide, cadmium sulfide. It's a powder that's placed onto a support plate, and you're using cathodoluminescence. You're using the impact of high-energy electrons to create visible light out. In the case of the green screen, it's chosen to be green because this is where we have the best eye sensitivity, and we use this combination of either zinc sulfide or zinc sulfide-cadmium sulfide blend to optimize the emission wavelength at around 550 or so, where our eyes are most sensitive. Some of you all were in lab yesterday when we lost the beam at one point, and you noticed that what I did is I shut the door, turned off all the lights, right, and got my eyes a little bit more adjusted, and then twiddled around with, in that case, the gun tilts until I started to see some little bit of intensity. And sometimes when you're working with the microscope, you really push on your eyes and the ability of the eye to see differences in intensity in particular. And so this becomes an important thing to consider, okay? And that's why this thing's optimized in the green. You use different grain sizes. In the bigger screen, we use about 100 to 500 micron grain size, 100 to 50 micron grain size. And then there's the little green screen, which we'll show you next in the labs as you start to do fine scale focus. There's an additional 10 times magnification to that screen, so we use a smaller grain size to get higher resolution out of that. Okay, but generally, this is the nature of this, is we're using that green screen just to create green visible light from the cathodoluminescence process. Okay, the thing that's nice about this is that the intensity you see is proportional to the current density of the electrons. And so what this means is if you're looking at an image and you see bright, then that's because in your sample there is a larger amount of electrons coming out in that area due to some effect, either mass thickness contrast or diffraction contrast or any of these other mechanisms we'll learn later. But what it means is that as we see things brighter, it means that that's because there's more electrons coming out of the sample in that region, and we can use that to infer something about the sample itself. Okay, so that's an important fact, is that this thing is proportional to the current density that comes out and into it. All right, the fluorescence occurs very quickly in terms of the materials that we're using, but you have a phosphorescence which occurs for a second or so afterwards, and so you do see that as a time lag. If you move your sample around, you will notice that the images have a bit of a ghost that shows up very, very briefly. An additional thing with this is that when we're using the microscope, right, we do all of our alignment by focusing the beam to a point on the optic axis. When we take our diffraction patterns, we always will put the direct beam, the to first order undiffracted beam, on top of that optic axis. And so it's not uncommon for there to be a big black area around there because we just eventually damage the phosphor. On the 2000EX we've been using, that hasn't been as big a problem because that machine is not as heavily used. But you'll notice on the 2000FX we use in the labs that there's a pretty wide area of dimmer intensity. And that's just something that will happen. And this happens relatively quickly, and so if you replace them, it doesn't really gain you that much time in terms of how long you get the thing to last. Okay, so that's how the fluorescent screen works. Again, it's just simple cathodoluminescence, conversion of the electrons to photons, right? We take the electron in, we have the electron advance from the valence band up to the conduction band, come back down, and then emit a photon out, and that's what we're seeing. Okay? So that's the fluorescent screen. Photographic film. If you want to take a permanent image of what you're seeing for the purposes of publication, for the purposes of explaining it to your boss, for the purpose of record keeping, you need to have something other than the green screen to take a permanent picture. For many years, photographic film was the preferred media to do this. And again, you will still find this in most microscopes as an option. Some of us prefer this for doing our best imaging for a couple reasons that you'll see. So photographic film is still something that we use. In the case of photographic film, what you're doing is you're using, nowadays, a polymer backing, and you're placing on top of that a silver halide crystal, silver bromine, silver chlorine. And what you do is you have the electrons come in, they'll strike those halide, silver halide crystals, and they will ionize them so that you have stored in that film ionized regions that you can later develop for the film, right, and create a negative. So if you're using film, what you get out of this process is you get a negative that you have to subsequently take to the dark room and process into a photo, or scan in with a high-resolution scanner in some mode, flip it in Photoshop to invert it, and use it from there. So photographic film is a bit of a pain in the neck, right, because you have to have a separate dark room. But the advantages to photographic film in particular is the final thing here, is that you have actually a very large number of pixels. So that if you want to get a very high resolution type of image, if you want to take an image that you can display over a very large area, photographic film is by far the best for doing so. I have a number of prints from my life that are, you know, several feet by several feet, and you can go up close to them, and they're sufficient resolution that they don't look pixelated. Whereas if you lose a CCD camera at 1K or 2K by 2K, you can only make the image so big, all right? Now, modern uses of the microscope, people are more just using it as a CCD to take pictures for publication, and that tends to be fine because you reduce the sizes enough anyway. But there's some of us old-time microscopy people that like the photographic film. Now, with using photographic film, there's a particular type of film that you use. It's Kodak SO-163 usually. There's a 165. These are specific films for X-ray and electron imaging. They are chosen because they have the appropriate grain size, because they have the appropriate interaction with the electrons. And usually what we use in the TEM is we use the faster speed so that we have an ability to convert these things more quickly and minimize the drift in our image. One thing of note is if you're using this stuff, it's often considered appropriate if you go to another lab to use the microscope to bring your own film. Because that's just a polite thing to do. If you do so, you need to be aware that you can't put it through the X-ray scanner. Okay? So that's just a comment. But it's something that's a polite thing to do. If you go to a lab, bring your own film, because it takes some of the resources away from them usually. Now, the advantage to film is, again, it has a large number of pixels. It has a high DQE. You get very good reproduction of what you see on the green screen to a very high level of resolution. And so film is very nice. The disadvantage, of course, is that it is analog and thus time-consuming. You have to learn how to run a dark room well. You have to keep your dark room up, full of good chemicals, things working properly. You have to get pretty good at photographic development to make it work. The other thing is that film has a relatively low dynamic range, and so that's not so good for things like diffraction patterns. And then probably most importantly, and this is, in my opinion, the thing that drives us away from this more than anything else, it's the inconvenience of the conversion, and also the fact that the conversion of electrons to intensity in that photographic plate is not linear. And so you can't do quantitative measurements unless you quantify that conversion, and it's tedious to do so. And so that's a major disadvantage, is it prevents you from doing quantitative work because you don't necessarily have the ability to convert the intensity of the image to the current density of electrons that cause that image. Okay, but that said, I still personally like film a lot. Resolution. So as I say, you've got a number of pixels there on the order of 10 to the 9. That's about the best way to describe it. Okay, if you're
compared to a 2K camera,
A 2K. So if you have a piece of film, it's usually 4 inches by 5 inches. Okay, and a 2K by 2K camera occupies probably 1/10 of that size. Okay, with 2,000 pixels. And so it's a much smaller imaging area and a much lower resolution. It's 10 to the, I'll have the numbers later, it's like 10 to the 6 versus 10 to the 9th in terms of number of total pixels. So it's a big difference. The image area is another thing too, is that it's in order to get large areas of image on a CCD, you have to place the image pretty far up the column, and that's just another complication. And nowadays, if you want to do a high-angle annular dark field stem, those two things compete for the same location in the column, so that's another issue too. So the film has a nice large area, and in particular that's good for dislocation imaging. Now the other type of thing that we use is a charge-coupled display device, device for the display of the electron-to-photon conversion. In this case, we're not converting to photons, the electron conversion into a signal intensity. I don't want to go into how CCDs work very much. The general idea of what a CCD is, though, is it's a metal oxide semiconductor field effect transistor that you operate so that you have a well within the interface between the oxide and the semiconductor. That well accepts electrons, it can store electrons, and then you can convert them out using different clocking schemes. And the idea is that what you get out of this is you get a direct conversion of electrons to an electronic signal that you can convert linearly, right? And that's what's nice, is the current density that comes into the CCD equals a linear intensity out. And so that's how this thing works. If you're interested, I can explain CCDs at another point. There's more information in the book. I don't think that's that useful. What's more useful about it in terms of your actual use of the CCD, it's an electronic device. It has individual pixels. Individual pixels see an electron, convert that to a signal. That's how it goes. But a CCD also has some other issues, because you have to have a couple of things go on to convert the electrons into the appropriate thing. Now, I think I just made a mistake there. I was saying that you have direct electron conversion. That was not what I intended to say. I apologize. What you're doing with the CCD is the electron comes in, and you actually have a scintillator that converts the electrons to photons, and then those photons are received by the CCD and cause an electron storage. So it gets a little complicated, so I misspoke there. Direct electron detection is another type of detector that's being developed, so forgive the mistake there. But the idea with the CCD is you have to have something that allows you to convert the electrons to the photons, and so what you need to do is you need to have the scintillator material to do that conversion. And you have to kind of balance all these things pretty appropriately, because what happens is you need to have a sufficient amount of the scintillator to get a reasonable amount of conversion, to get a reasonable yield of the photons. But the problem is as you thicken the scintillator, you also get some spread laterally, and that causes a degradation in the point spread function. And so the way that these things are put together is you have the physical chip down here that's a CCD. You link it with a set of fiber optics that takes the photons out of the scintillator, and basically that's where the conversion happens. It happens at the CCD, and there's a conversion of electrons to photons in the scintillator, and then it's pushed down onto the CCD. The thing that happens with this, though, is when you buy the camera itself, you need to kind of be aware of how much blooming is happening. You need to be aware of the fact that there's particular amounts of blooming that vary with the electron energy coming in. So if you have a higher energy electron, you need to change the scintillator characteristics to match that well. And so there's some optimization in all of this. But that's the general way that this works. Now, the fiber optic bundle is used to try to channel this down directly so that when you have the light coming out of the scintillator, it doesn't continue to spread further down. And so that helps to increase the resolution to lower the point spread function. But the problem with that scintillator, with that fiber optic bundle, is you have to kind of take a picture of it to get rid of it. Now, this doesn't show up too clearly in your handouts, but if you look, do you see this little hexagon? It looks like kind of like a honeycomb bee, honeycomb network. What that is it's a picture of the scintillator, a picture of the fiber optic bundle. And so when you go through and use a CCD, you have to do a couple of steps to get rid of that. This is a picture that was taken without all those steps so that you can actually see the fiber optic bundle. You can see some scratches in the aluminum film that's on the top of that. In other words, this is a picture of what the camera looks like and what your image looks like. Generally, when you use the CCD, you have to have what's called a gain reference prepared as well as a dark reference. And the gain reference is used to take a picture of the camera itself, and then you subtract that picture off from all the pictures you obtain, right? And so it's the same as with the modern, if you buy a very fancy camera these days, you can do like a dust and scratches image on one of your digital SLR cameras. And so you can take a picture of any scratches that might be on the lens, and then it subtracts all of those things out of all of your pictures that you're taking. I don't know if you've noticed that. It's a new technology out. I like that sort of stuff. And so this the same sort of idea is that you take a picture of the camera that you have, and then every time you take a picture of anything, it automatically subtracts all these little defects and faults out. Okay? So that's an important part, is to have a good gain reference prepared. It's something that the operator of the microscope, the primary operator, will make sure is in good shape, and you'll learn how to do this as well. Additionally, you take a dark reference image. This is one where there's no intensity at all displayed on the camera, and really this is just a shot noise image. It's telling you what's the noise within there that's just the random fluctuations due to the electronics and background. And so what you do when you get your final image with a CCD is you have the actual picture that you're interested in, and you subtract out the gain reference, you subtract out the dark reference, and you get thus a reasonably good conversion of the real image showing up as your final picture. So these things are all done automatically. One of the problems with these things is they take time computationally to do, and so this is something that can make it a little bit slow to refresh, but this is less and less of a problem with each generation of computers because it's starting to be relatively fast to do this. With the case of the CCD, there's a number of advantages to CCDs, and the reason that they're really finding increasing use is that they have a very good DQE. They give very good signal-to-noise output versus signal-to-noise input. They have the ability to do this at relatively low levels of signal. That's very attractive for people doing biological and polymer imaging in particular. It's also good for doing high resolution imaging, so it allows you to spread your beam and have a less focused or converged beam, so that's very handy. They also have a very high dynamic range, and so you can do diffraction patterns on top of the CCD. You have to be careful because you don't want to overexpose the CCD, but you can do diffraction work on the CCD, and that's very handy. Thus, because of the fact that they're also linear in terms of their conversion of current density to a measurable intensity, you can use that to do quantitative diffraction studies. So if you have a relative differences in intensity, you can go back and correlate that to measurements, to predictions, and use that to do quantitative work on your diffraction pattern or your image. They're also really, really convenient, right? You know, it's all digital. You stick your flash drive in, you walk home with your images. You can do all the processing on Photoshop that you need, and that's much easier than going to the darkroom, okay? So that's the real advantages. The disadvantage, I think, is they do have a little less resolution. You have a substantial difference between them and film. If you look, right, film, something on the order of 10 to the 9 image points versus a 1 times 10 to the minus 6 for a 1K by 1K camera. Initially, the purchase of one of these things is relatively expensive, but most recent analyses, and these are analyses that people really do because it matters, right? It turns out that they're cheaper over the reasonable lifetime of them, right? Because if you cost in all the cost of the film, keeping up the darkroom, making sure all the chemicals are up to date, in the end, it's a cheaper thing to do these days. So if you can afford to buy one and skip the darkroom, that's great. These numbers here are about 2005 numbers. I don't update this every year because it's too much work, but this is still about right. A 1K by 1K camera is about $50,000 to buy. A 2K by 2K around $80,000. You're now seeing 4K by 4K and I believe even 8K by 8K coming out, and only the biologists with their much more substantial NIH grants are able to afford these. So I've yet to see anyone I know have a 4K by 4K camera in the materials world. We work cheaper, not by choice. Generally, you have pretty slow readouts because of things like dark subtraction, gain subtraction, but you can get up to about 15 frames a second at 1K by 1K. About a year ago, I bought a 15 frame per second camera at 1K by 1K, and I'm pretty happy with it. That's pretty good. So if you're trying to do dynamic studies, if you're trying to look at changes in your material with heating and the like, you're now even able to do it all digital, and that's pretty handy. So it used to be, back when I was a young man, we did all this on videotape and converted the videotape, and it was just a complete pain. But now you can just stream it onto the hard drive, and that's much nicer. So you get reasonable readout rates with the CCD. So this is skewing, in my opinion, more and more towards advantages, less and less away from the disadvantages. And so with time, I think photographic film will be only for people that are old school, you might say. Now, other things about the CCD, pardon me, is it's very important when you use the CCD for diffraction patterns to be careful. And we'll teach this in detail in the labs, because you can screw things up and do permanent damage that's expensive. If you overexpose a diffraction pattern, you will get too many electrons in a given pixel, and you can damage it permanently, okay? And then everybody who uses the camera after that has this one big bright spot in their image, and everyone hates you for it, okay? So that's something to avoid. We will teach you how to do this fairly carefully. As you go to higher and higher levels of exposure, you start to see these sort of weird effects that happen because you have so many electrons coming in, creating so many electron hole pairs through this conversion process that they start to leak over to the next pixel and the next pixel and the next pixel. And sometimes what you'll find is a streak down because it'll overload all of the pixels along a given pathway as it goes to ground out at the edge. So in addition to being ugly, as I say, you don't want to publish something like this unless you absolutely have to. It just looks bad. It also makes quantification difficult because you have no longer a linear match between the intensity of things. So we'll teach you how to take diffraction patterns to avoid this, but that's one of the things to be aware of with CCDs. Now, the final thing, too, is that if you have the choice between film and CCD, you can use either of these for different things. I like film for large area images. I like diffraction contrast images on film. You have a bit more dynamic range across the areas that you're looking at. Usually with diffraction contrast images we'll talk about later, you have lots of black and white levels of intensity. They're kind of gradual, and so you have a larger area over which to do things. And I think dislocation images and diffraction contrast images still come out better on film. In the case of CCDs, though, quantitative diffraction in imaging, high resolution imaging in particular, all of these things are best off on the CCD. And you know, there are other types of media that you can use. In particular, there's a thing called image plates that are very nice for quantitative work, but we'll get into that at a later point when we start to do quantitative diffraction. And so really my goals for this portion of the lecture was simply to show you, you know, how these things work and give you a sense as to what you're looking at when you look at electron-photon conversion.